Jessica Alba, if you don't stop fighting with Megan Fox over me, I'm going to break up with both of you. I don't care how much you paid to go out with me. I'm just glad my students aren't here to see this. Shamelessly throwing yourselves at me. So, here we go. Last we ended, I believe we were talking about the Supreme Court. And, we were about to get to the Supreme Court. We were finishing up with the senators and how they, to the approval of the Senate is required. The duty of the Senate is advise and consent to the president. And the last example I gave, I believe, was a treaty. You needed 2/3 of the senators to ratify a treaty. So, now, we'll perhaps come back to this, the Senate and everything like that, but now we need to address another branch of our government, the judiciary branch. And we need to address specifically the Supreme Court. Now, please write this down. There's a test term within it. Since the Judiciary Act, and that should be capitalized, Judiciary Act. Since the Judiciary Act of 1869, comma, there have been 9, write the number 9, don't spell out N-I-N-E. Since the Judiciary Act of 1869, there have been 9 justices with a capital J. Open parentheses. Not judges, close parentheses, on the Supreme Court, period. And Supreme Court should be capitalized. So, since the Judiciary Act of 1869, there have been 9 justices. 9 with a number, open parentheses, not judges, close parentheses. On the Supreme Court, period. The test term is 9. So this is significant here. How many justices do we have on the Supreme Court? We have 9. We don't have 8. We don't have 10. We don't have even numbers. See, the Romans always followed that principle of collegiality, which is that they should be more than one person in every office. And it should be an even number. That way they balanced each other out. And they could always veto the other. Veto is Latin for I forbid. So they wanted a system that could easily be stopped, easily blocked. And we, since we copied that system, in our government, things are very easy to stop and grind to a halt. However, this Supreme Court, they are extraordinarily powerful. They are the law. They decide what is and is not permissible. They say 5 is the most important number in our government because 5 Supreme Court justices, meaning a majority of this 9, if they decide something is legal, it is legal. If they decide it is illegal, it is illegal. That is it. No questions asked. Anything happens, you get arrested, anything like that, you can appeal it, and you can appeal it higher and higher and higher and higher. Sometimes you can appeal it all the way up to the Supreme Court. Once they make a decision, there are no more appeals. What they say is final. Now, take the case of Miranda. I'm sure a number of you have heard of Miranda rights and have some idea of them. You have the right to remain silent if you anything you say or do can and will be used against you in a court of law, that sort of thing. But what is it? Well, this guy Ernesto Miranda in the 1960s, he committed a very minor crime, and then when they took him into custody, he wound up being, it was revealed, and he confessed to a major, major crime, the beating and rape of a woman and robbery of a teenage woman. And that's fine, he was convicted, Then he appealed. He appealed all the way up to the Arizona Supreme Court. This happened in the state of Arizona. And they said, no, it doesn't matter that you weren't told that you didn't have to speak to the police, and you could have, even though you couldn't afford an attorney, one would have been appointed to you. It doesn't matter. You're still guilty. He appealed. His last level he could appeal to was the Federal Supreme Court of the United States. And they, in a 5-4 decision, tossed out his confession. They said, no, the defendant, Miranda, should have been informed clearly. He had this right, he had that right, everything like that. And the conviction was vacated, so he got a new trial. Now, he wound up being convicted anyway, because there was other evidence they were able to bring up and everything like that. But the confession which he had initially given and the conviction that came from it were thrown out, the first one. So that's what it is. This is, and by the way, it's very interesting because of that first trial being vacated and the Supreme Court ruling, that's why police departments all over the country started issuing Miranda warning cards, they were called, so that their police officers could recite them once the officers arrested someone and looked to question them. Now, it's very interesting because Miranda, even though he was convicted, he was paroled after about 11 years, and then once he got out, he started selling autographed Miranda warning cards for about $1.50. And it's even more interesting, he got out on parole, and then for various little things he did, he basically violated his parole and then went back to prison. Then he got released again, and about a month afterward, if I remember correctly, just 1 month afterward, he was playing this card game in a bar, and then somebody accused him of cheating, and he got stabbed to death just about a month after being paroled the second time. And this is poetic justice, I guess you would say. The police came to talk to the two people who he was with, and they were both questioned, but first the officers read them the Miranda rights in Spanish, and so the two people knew they didn't have to speak to the police and this and that, and the police had to let them go. Eventually, they found out, it really was one of those two people. It almost certainly was one of those two who stabbed him to death. But because they had read the Miranda rights and the people knew not to speak to the police, that they didn't have to speak to the police, they were released initially, and they got away. They were never apprehended. So, Ernesto Miranda stabbed to death, and the person who did it, almost certainly the person who did it, got away because of those Miranda rights. In fact, it may have been because he didn't die immediately. Miranda was bleeding out. So the very last words he might have heard are the police telling his two associates, "You have the right to remain silent. Anything you do or say may be used against you in a court of law." So interesting the way life works out. But this is what we're talking about when it comes to the Supreme Court. Anything they decide is legal. That's it. There is no higher law in the land. There is the President of the United States, arguably the most powerful person in the world. He goes to give the State of the Union address to the country, okay? He goes, and if you watch it on TV, all the networks are covering it that night. And you will see every single person in the audience of importance in the government. You'll see all the congressmen and women. You'll see all the senators. You'll see the generals, the admirals. You will see basically anyone of extreme importance in our government is there. And when the president walks in, all of them jump to their feet. Everyone stands when the president walks into the room to show respect. People who hate the president, people who can't stand the president, still will stand to show respect for the president. But if you ever watch a State of the Union address, you will see the entire mass of people all over the in the seats, standing up, except for 9 of them in the front row. They are the only people who will remain seated. They are the justices of the Supreme Court. They don't rise for the president. They answer to no one. Nothing and no one is above the Supreme Court. So, this is what it is. And if you recall, I had said that's why French philosopher, let's say Montesquieu, had come up with this. Montesquieu studied the Roman Republic, I told you, and said, what went wrong? Well, they needed some sort of Supreme Court which could say, no, this action you're taking is not constitutional. It is an illegal action. So, each state has its own Supreme Court and everything like that. That's why it's really the federal Supreme Court. But that's what it is, and there's a chief justice. So there are 9 justices, but one of them is a chief justice who has a little bit more power and a little bit more authority. Now, how do these justices get their jobs? How do they get their jobs? For how long do they have their jobs? Well, some of you know the answers to this question. They are justices for life. For life or until they choose to retire. Now, how do they get these jobs? Some of you may know a little bit, but even those people will tend to make a very serious mistake. Very serious mistake. So write this down. There are 2 test terms within it. To become a Supreme Court justice. To become a Supreme Court justice. Open parentheses. When there is a vacancy. Close parentheses. To become a Supreme Court justice. Open parentheses. When there is a vacancy. Close parentheses. A person must be nominated by the president. Nominated by the president, open parentheses, not appointed. And put an exclamation mark after that. Maybe put 3 exclamation marks. Smiley face, hashtag, whatever you millennials do. But nominated by the president, open parentheses, not appointed. Exclamation mark, close parentheses. And approved by the Senate, period. And approved by the Senate, period. There are 2 test terms there. One is nominated by the president. The other, as you might guess, is approved by the Senate. Approved by the Senate. So, why did I make such a big deal out of that nominated by the president, not appointed? I know some of you were probably thinking, ah, yes, appointed by the president. Well, that's a major, major misstatement because even though you may hear this on the news and things like that, the president does not get to appoint these people. The president can nominate them. And then what was the main duty of the Senate? To advise and consent to the president. So just like I said with these other things like a treaty, you have to get approval from the Senate. The president can't just do this unilaterally. Well, same thing when there's a Supreme Court justice. The president will look and see, okay, what is this? What are the credentials? How long has this person served? What is their reputation? Everything like that. And the president is looking for someone that reflects their beliefs. So the president believes, let's say, in gun rights, in you have the right to bear whatever arms you want, everything like that, does not like abortion, does want this, does want that. So the president is going to find a judge who believes that way, and then nominate him to be a Supreme Court justice. Now, actually, you don't have to have been a judge. Technically, you don't even have to have been a lawyer, but they're all lawyers, and I believe they've all been judges in the past. But the president is going to nominate someone who believes the same way he does. And then the Senate will question them up, down, and sideways. There will be Senate hearings. People from both sides, Democrats and Republicans, will be asking them all sorts of questions. And it's not only about their legal knowledge. It could be other things. Our most recent Supreme Court Justice, Brett Kavanaugh, a lot of controversy because in college there was this allegation that he basically forced himself on a woman, not rape, but forced himself on a woman at a party. So he disputed that the incident happened, everything like that. But all these questions are brought out, and they look very carefully. And the Senate does not always approve or confirm the president's nominee. George W. Bush, he nominated someone to be on the Supreme Court named Harriet Myers, saying, I know her heart and this and that, and she's this. But the Senate questioned her quite thoroughly. They didn't find her to have a satisfactory amount of legal knowledge to be on the Supreme Court. So George Bush had to find somebody else, nominated someone else, and that one did get approved. So this is the way it is, and you see over and over again these checks and balances. Again, it's not a coincidence that our country has done so well over such a short period of time. We've succeeded amazingly. Well, a lot of that is due to our having a very good form of government. Similarly, the government has a bunch of different departments, over a dozen different departments. Department of Agriculture, Department of Energy, Department of Defense, Department of State, everything like that. And that needs someone leading it who answers to the president. When our country was being founded, well, other countries, you know, when our country was being founded, other countries named this person in charge of a department a minister. Okay, minister of war, minister of defense, minister of the economy, whatever it is, minister of finance. We didn't like that because that had too many royal connotations. By the way, the word minister is connected to the word mini and minus. It means a lesser person. So in Europe, they were called ministers because they're not the king, they're a lesser person. Even in religion, it's a lesser person. That's not God, that's not whatever it is. It is a lesser person. And we, even though that would have been an accurate enough title for us to use for these heads of the departments, again, it seemed too close to royalty, and it's not suitable for a republic. So we said, we're not going to do that. What else can we do? Well, in Europe, they also had these kings and powerful people. They had their own journals that needed to be kept, their appointments, all these things that needed to be managed in their lives, the king or queen or whoever it is. And this stuff is secret. It's confidential. And you basically secrete, you like sweat secretions or poisonous secretions, whatever. To secrete is to move aside, to push aside. Basically, that's where the word secret comes from, something that's not open to the public. And what would you call someone who keeps these secrets? Well, you would call them a secretary. And so since this job existed in Europe with these people who help the person in charge, the king or the queen or whoever it is, we said, yes, that's a more business-like term. That's a term that's suitable for a republic. We'll call our heads of these departments secretaries. And so we do. Secretary of Agriculture, Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, Secretary of whatever it is. Together, they make up the cabinet. They're called the president's cabinet. And it's 14 secretaries exactly, I believe. And then there's a 15th member of the cabinet. So it's those 14 secretaries, and the 15th is the Attorney General of the United States. And how do they get their jobs? How do all these people get their jobs? Same way. Nominated by the president, approved or confirmed by the Senate. I don't know if any of you watched this when it was on the Cleveland show, but I remember there was an episode where, this was years and years ago, I mean the show has been off the air for years, but where the character on this cartoon show, Cleveland, he says, he keeps saying throughout the entire episode, oh, I once played Barack Obama in a game of one-on-one basketball and I beat him. And nobody believes him. Finally, at the end of the episode, Air Force One lands in the street in front of their house, and Obama comes out and says, hey, Cleveland, I hear you've been talking trash about me. And one of the Secret Service pulls out the football. That's what this briefcase is that they always carry with the president. It's like a metal briefcase, but when you open it up, it has the ability to launch nuclear missiles and everything like that. That's why they always keep it with the president. Anytime that he moves, anywhere he is in the world, he can always launch a nuclear strike. So, opens that up, and it turns out to be a basketball. And they play a game of one-on-one, and President Obama beats Cleveland Brown. And then he starts saying, oh, I should call my Secretary of Education because you just got schooled. I should call my Secretary of Treasury because that shot was money. Then the Secret Service are saying, sir, we really have to go. And President Obama says, wait, I just got one more. I should call my Secretary of Defense because I am the bomb. And by the way, that's a relatively recent change. Secretary of Defense, Department of Defense, it used to be called until about 70 years ago. It was called the Department of War and the Secretary of War, but we changed it to make it seem less threatening and less warlike. We're a nation of peace. But anyway, we turn our attention now to the House of Representatives. So, the House is far less glamorous than the Senate. Okay, I had mentioned that before. The Senate is based on the Roman Senate. The House of Representatives is based on the Roman Plebeian Assembly. And certainly, it's an impressive thing to be a representative, to be a congressperson, as they say, but it's nothing like being a senator. And the example I always use, I know we got a couple of at least two military people in the class, I have always throughout the years used the comparison that the House of Representatives is like the Army Rangers. Definitely an impressive thing, definitely clearly much well above average, above the average thing. But senators, I compare to special forces, especially back in the day. Special forces, it's almost that you had to be genetically geared toward getting in because the standard is so, so high. That's what it is with the Senate. And until maybe 20 years ago or so, there has always been a huge difference. You could tell, even from looking at photos of them, which one was a senator and which one was a representative. The senators just dressed much better. When you hear them speak, they speak at a much higher level, more gravitas, more this, more that. So it's much more prestigious, much more powerful to be in the Senate. But And how many are there, by the way? Senators, we agreed there were two per state, and there are 50 states, therefore there are a total of 100 senators. Let's write this down as a test term. Since 1913, comma, there have been 435, write 4, 3, and 5. Write the numbers, don't spell it out. Since 1913, there have been 435 members in the House of Representatives, period. Members in the House of Representatives, period. And House of Representatives should always be capitalized as well. Now, really, how on earth did this number get so big? Well, firstly, how do the senators get their job? How do these representatives get their positions to begin with? How long are they in office? All these questions we need to get into. Now, let's have a couple more test terms before I get into this. Write this down, please. So this previous thing I told you to write down, the test term is 435. So I told you to write down, since 1913, there have been 435 members in the House of Representatives. The test term is 435. Write this next thing down. It's got test terms. Members of the House, and House should be capitalized, members of the House are elected for terms of 2, write the number 2, years, period. Continue writing. Their only exclusive power is, taxation. T-A-X-A-T-I-O-N, as in Nancy, period. So members of the House are elected for terms of 2 years, period. Their only exclusive power is taxation. The test terms are 2 years and taxation. So, remember, you need the full thing. There's no partial credit or anything like that. On the exam, if you just write the number 2, you won't get credit. No, oh, you know what I meant, and this and that. And that's why I commented to a couple of you that when you're highlighting or doing whatever it is to the test term, make sure you don't just write test term in front of it or put a star in front of it or anything like that. Make sure it is either highlighted or underlined or whatever it is, because you need to know when the test term ends as well. That way you're not only writing part of the test term, or you're not writing too much or whatever it is. So 2 years and taxation, those are the things. Now, one more test term before we get into this explanation. Because again, this is another one of those times when usually you'll get a couple of students who have some idea of what the answer is, which is how do we decide how many representatives a state gets? We understand they get 2 senators each state, but how do we determine how many representatives a state gets? A number of you are probably thinking by population. A few of you might know that, but that would not exactly be correct. So write this down and then I'll explain all of this. Each state is, quote, apportioned, APPORTIONED, close quote. Each state is, quote, apportioned, close quote, representatives by population relative to the country's population, period. Each state is, quote, apportioned, close quote, representatives by population relative to the country's population, period. The test term is by population. The test term is by population. Now we get into it. See, what happened is, what some of you might know, okay, population, that's how we determine represent. I myself, in a previous lecture, I told you the small states wanted everything equal, the big states wanted majority rules, so they compromised. And one of the ways they compromised is, in the Senate, every state is equal. Every state gets two senators, no matter how big or small they are. House of Representatives, majority rule. The big states like California, Texas, Florida, we have many, many more representatives than the little states. So it's balanced out. Representatives by population. But when the Founding Fathers set this up, they said, okay, fine, it's by population. And therefore, as the years and decades went by, states got more and more population. Our country grew in population. And so they got more and more representatives. It wasn't planned out to be hundreds and hundreds of these representatives, but that's just a natural outgrowth of the population growing. And it got all the way up to 435, which is outrageous. They passed a law. They said, you know what? This is already too unwieldy. We are not going to let it get any more extreme than this. And they passed a law in 1911. It only went into effect after the 1912 elections, but they passed this law in 1911, freezing it, 435 and no more. We can't just add more and more and more. So it is fixed at 435. And now, instead of being based on population purely, it is based on a state's population relative to the country's population. That means if Florida's population has been steadily going up all throughout the years because of our weather and things like that. If Florida's population goes up 10%, before, under the old rules, we would get 10% more representatives. But after they passed this rule, if our population went up 10% and every other state's population went up 10%, what would happen is nothing would change. Nothing would change. Our population has to go up relative to the country's population. So if our population went up 10% and no one else's went up, then we would get an increase. And how do we still keep it at 435? Well, remember, if our population has relatively gone up, that means some other states has relatively gone down and they lose representation. States with population declines, they get actually some of their representatives taken away from them to give them to the higher population states. That's the way it works. How do they know a state's population? Well, some of you might have an idea of this. Some of you might even have worked for these people. Just like in ancient Rome in the Senate, they had these offices called censors. Really pronounced censors, but censors. And you guys have heard of censorship. You've heard of censors. You've heard of these things. What that comes from is these original offices where in the Senate, these censors were meant to watch the senators and see if there's any kind of corruption. Senators are doing something wrong, incompetence, whatever it is. And so we get different things from that. Censorship, just keeping bad stuff out, stopping bad stuff from going on. We also get census, which keeps track of the population. And here in America, we have that census conducted every 10 years, and it's pretty important because the bigger your population, the more power you will get. And the less your population, the less power you will get. So they go around checking these populations, everything like that. And Florida, as I've said, has consistently gone up and up and up in population. In fact, if I do the history of Miami and history of Florida lecture, I'll go over why Miami is called the Magic City. I mean, some many of you have heard it referred to as that. Different cities have different nicknames. The Windy City, you know, New York is the that's Chicago. New York is the Big Apple. So Philadelphia is the city of brotherly love. Miami is the Magic City. And there's a, because basically it seemed to spring up out of nowhere. All of a sudden its population skyrocketed. Well, there's reasons for that. It didn't just skyrocket out of nowhere. There's a reason. Something gave it a gigantic leap forward. Now, I also said that these the House of Representatives has only one exclusive power. By that I mean the House of Representatives and the Senate have a lot of overlapping responsibilities, a lot of overlapping powers. There are some things that are exclusive. For example, the Senate, when it comes to foreign policy, the Senate handles that exclusively. The House of Representatives just keeps its mouth shut, has nothing to say because it's not the House of Representatives' responsibility. It's not its place to weigh in on that. The one exclusive power the House does have, meaning the Senate does not have this one power, is taxation. The House will decide how much or how little the American people have to pay in taxes. Now, partly for that reason, if these people decide how much of your money they get to take, you need that ability to vote them out quickly. They need to be answerable, not like the senators who get 6 years. And again, this all makes sense. You see, this is well thought out and very reasonably done. When you see senators, I gave the example just now of foreign policy. Okay? There are various reasons why senators are in for such a long time, for 6 years. It's because, firstly, you need time to settle in, to learn the job, learn what's going on, rather than just keep churning them in and out with a quick turnover. You need to give them time to learn the job. You also want them to have, when you're in office, when you're a politician, you spend most of your time asking for campaign contributions, asking for support in terms of votes, campaigning, everything like that. Over the past years, campaigns have started earlier and earlier and earlier. And with the House of Representatives, for example, they only have 2-year terms. This is the truth. When representatives get elected, they basically immediately start campaigning for re-election, because 2 years is not a very long time. 6 years is considerably longer, so now these senators can actually get some work done. And they're also insulated from public reaction, since these duties are so important. Foreign policy. They shouldn't be worried all the time that, oh, if I make this unpopular decision, I'll get voted out. Going to war, this war in Iraq, which we've been in forever now, basically. When the President George W. Bush was trying to get us to go to war with Iraq, and the country, this is right after September 11th, really was looking, oh, we need to hit back, we need to get revenge, we need to get justice, whatever it is. Well, the thing is, Iraq did not attack us. Iraq had nothing to do with September 11th. And the way our system is built, the way our system is designed, the senators did not need to vote for war. They did not need to be afraid, oh, the people are going to vote us out if we don't vote for this war. They could have said, no, we don't care what you say, were voting against it. Now, they voted for it, but that's not the fault of the system. The system would have protected them if they had voted to keep us out. And it's the same thing with a lot of these different things. So the Senate is insulated from the people's reactions. The House, again, they get to take our money or not take our money. Therefore, we want them answerable immediately. They better have a very good explanation for why they raised our taxes or why they didn't cut our taxes, whatever it is, or else they're out. The presidency. the presidency. The founding fathers gave the presidency an enormous amount of power. Now we're looking at this thing. But actually, some of the founding fathers wanted to give the president far more power than he even has now. They were looking around the world. They said, you have these kings, you have these emperors, you have these all-powerful people. We need to give our leader enormous amounts of power just to be able to match up to these foreign leaders. We need to give him an impressive title. And, you know, what they settled on was president, which is far from an impressive title. They were arguing quite seriously for titles like His Highness or His High Mightiness, things like that. Very seriously, they were arguing for that. I mean, who would respect someone with the title of president? What does it mean? Presides over. That's what it means. But we were very concerned about our freedom here, very concerned about some possible dictator or tyrant taking over, about power going to the leader's head. And so we settled on this. And in fact, just so you know, really there is no manual for how to be president. There is no rule book that says you need to do this, you need to do that. And most of it was modeled after our very first elected president, George Washington. He set the precedent for what needs to be done. Basically, what that means is there was no rule book for it, and so what he did basically set the standard for all future presidents to copy. This must be how a president should do things. This must be what a president should be responsible for. And that's what it is. He, you know, many of you know, a president can only be president for 2 terms. Can only be elected for 2 terms. That was not a law through most of our history. George Washington, way he became president, that's right, unanimous, everybody wanted him, that's great. Gets reelected 2nd time. But then he says 2 terms is enough. Any more than that, and it's becoming a less democratic, less republican form of government, and it's drifting toward monarchy. And, you know, when the presidency was being created, a number of people wanted the president to be, okay, you can have him elected, but he needs to be elected for life. So they wanted us to vote for president, yes, but once we voted for them, they would be president for the rest of their lives. Can you imagine these things now? If that had gone through, His High Mightiness, Donald Trump, elected for life. Well, that could have been. It could have been the way things went. Anyway, so the president, Washington, he said no, 2 terms is enough, and he stopped after that 2nd term, and he did not run again, even though he almost certainly would have won. So since he did that, every president after him, not because they were required to, but because he did it, they ran twice, and that was it. They served 2 terms, and that was it. They walked away voluntarily. Until fairly recently, maybe 80 years ago approximately, you see, just before and during World War II, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. He ran and won. Then he did it again. Then he did it a 3rd time, not following the convention, not following the precedent that every other president had done. He ran and won a 3rd time. He ran and won a 4th time. And then he died in office. But everybody got so worried, hey, this is not good. We need to make this 2-term thing a law rather than just the precedent that everybody follows. We need to make this a law. And then they wrote it into law, no more than 2 terms. That's one of the reasons we were lucky to have George Washington as our first president, somebody who wanted this country to be free, to be democratic, to be republican. His men, after the Revolutionary War, actually wanted to make him king. King Washington, these are the soldiers who kicked out the British. They wanted their leader, their general, Washington, to be king, but Washington said no. In fact, the only thing he really did that was undemocratic was his way of greeting people. He would bow to people, and later on, Thomas Jefferson, shortly after, he changed it. That's the one thing I can think of, and out of all the different things Washington did, big and small, the one thing Washington did that was changed was Thomas Jefferson, who was very much for the common farmer, for the common people. He found it to be too aristocratic to be bowing when you greet someone. So when Thomas Jefferson became president, he changed it to a handshake. And that's why the president to this day shakes hands with people rather than having them bow to him and him bowing back. You can actually tell, I don't want to go off, again, I've cut a lot of these tangents out of the lectures, but there's so much interesting stuff here. Some of you may have heard why we shake hands or the story behind it. We don't know. We don't know for sure, but the story has always been that you want to make sure that the other person is not carrying a weapon in their arm. Most people are right-handed, and so you are seeing that they don't have a weapon, and you are showing them that you don't have a weapon. It's interesting that so many of our customs are based on how much we human beings screw each other over. You all know about toasting. How to toast a drink or anything like that, you may have heard the story behind it. We don't know this for sure, but the story is, you know, you go over to eat with someone or drink with them, you go to their house, they come to your house, something like that. The story is you would clink glasses to spill your drink into their drink. That way, if they had poisoned you, they would be having the poison in their own glass as well. It's that type of thing. And with these greetings, there's reasons for every little thing. I can tell you the history of why we salute, why it's called a salute, 21 gun salute, all this kind of stuff with even the greetings. I mean, you can tell a lot of about a culture from the way it greets people and from the culture in general. If you see in Asia, very respectful culture, in Japan, in China, in Korea, places like that, when they greet each other, they bow deeply. They lower themselves in front of the other person as a show of respect and courtesy. In India, they put their palms together as if they're praying, touch them gently to their heart, bow slightly and say namaste, which translates to, the light within me salutes the light within you, namaste. And in America, we lift our chin up and say, sup, dog. We raise ourselves above the other person and call them a dog. Anyway. Now, the presidency. Much as I would like to go into some other tangents and everything here, especially food stuff. For some reason, this is coincidentally a bunch of that. With the toast, it's called a toast because it goes back to the ancient Romans, and it involved this burned bread. You know, and Jefferson here, for my McDonald's student who's busy working at McDonald's rather than doing my notes. What happens is, why are they called French fries? What's going on with that? Now, there's a controversy. Did they come from Belgium? Did they come from France? But either way, how did they wind up here? Well, what happened is Thomas Jefferson was ambassador to France. Then later on, he became president. Well, when you're president, the White House will make you anything you want to eat anytime, especially when you're hosting these banquets and everything like that. And Jefferson had requested, serve me fried potatoes in the French manner or something like that. Serve me potatoes, French fried. Where's that effect? They said, what is that? And he said, well, you slice it up and then you deep fry it, and that's how you make it. And that's how we got. Now, they weren't the long rectangular things that we have today. They were sliced horizontally. So they were like thick discs, like thick coins of potatoes. That's how they were. And they also didn't look this golden brown color of ours today. That's because they spray, whether it's McDonald's or whoever it is, they spray sugar on it before they ship it out to the franchises. And then when it fries, that caramelizes, the sugar caramelizes, and that's why it gives it that golden brown look. But anyway, let's move on. And even though we are moving on, and we're not going too deeply into this stuff, you should really have it in your notes about what I said about French fries and everything like that. Not that you need to, but really you should, because again, what we're doing is training skills, training abilities. As I was saying to one of you on the phone, I reiterated something I said on the first day of class. That football player would never run tires in an actual game. So why are they doing it? That boxer would never jump rope in an actual boxing ring. So why are they doing it? I don't know if I mentioned this, but the chess. It's been said that this is the story of why chess was invented. It's because the old warriors wanted to teach the young warriors not to rush into battle. These young men, these young teenage guys, everything like that, they want to prove their manhood. They rush in aggressively, thinking they're invincible, and they get killed. And if they happen to survive long enough through enough battles, then they would eventually learn, oh, this is a bad idea. We need to be more cautious and not rush in. But so many of the soldiers had died by then that they came up with this game. This is the story. They came up with this game of chess to show, okay, you play. The young warriors would bring out their most powerful piece immediately. The queen, of course, it was called something else back then, but bring it out. Queen gets killed and they lose the game. They play again. Same thing. Very aggressively, they lose. Again, very aggressively, they lose over and over again. And then they can learn through these examples, which seem to have nothing to do with real combat, but in fact, it has everything to do with it. They are understanding, don't rush forward blindly. Hold back. The pawns go first. In boxing, there's a saying, the jab is like a cane to a blind man. The jab is like a cane to a blind man. You're feeling what's out there. You're checking what's out there. Not just going in with that right cross trying to knock the person out. So it's like that. But in a general sense, we're learning from these examples. In physics, when you see there's a super common example to explain gravity and everything, where if a bowling ball and a feather is dropped at the same time from the same height, which one lands first? Well, trick question. Assuming it's a vacuum, both the bowling ball and the feather land at the same time. Now, why are we doing it? Why is this tangent? Why are we talking about bowling balls and feathers? We're supposed to be talking about gravity. The thing is, it is not off topic. In fact, it is directly 1,000% on topic. But we need that ability for abstract, we need that ability to see and understand principles and concepts and rules. And sometimes we've heard it so many times that it's not a problem. We understand immediately why something is being brought up. If somebody says, don't put all your eggs in one basket, we were familiar enough with it to know, oh, the person's not giving us advice on how to be a chicken farmer. This is advice on diversifying, having your thing in different places, not all in one place. So these are things that you understand, but we need to develop these skills to a higher level. And the way to do that is just by taking notes on everything. Everything. If I am kind of racing ahead here, otherwise I would explain more about the notes and why they have to be done this way. and what the point, why I do certain things that I do. But again, we'll just move forward here. So the presidency. We see this is, how is the president elected? That is the most misunderstood thing in our government by people here in this country and all around the world. But I will explain it to you in a very abbreviated way, very quickly, and then you will understand, oh, okay, this is how it is. This is how the president becomes president. Now, about 700 years ago, there was the Holy Roman Empire. And they needed a Holy Roman Emperor. And how do they choose the Holy Roman Emperor? Well, it was a number of ways, depending on when you look at it. But in 1356, they agreed on a formal way to do this. Okay, it's not that it had never been done before, but they kind of formalized it, 1356. In fact, this is known as the Golden Bull of 1356, B-U-L-L. When I first heard about this, I thought, oh, it's some like a cow or something like that. No. Bull is short for bula, which means seal. And what it is even today we have notaries that stamp something, leave an imprint and everything like that when it's an important document. Well, back in the day, when you had something really, really important, an important document in business or government or whatever it is, you would melt wax and you would put your signet on that, a ring or a stamp or something like that, as a seal. And the seal was known as a bula. So that was a wax thing if it was important. If it was really important, they would use lead. And if it was really, really, really important, they would use, guess what metal? Gold. Gold. So this bula would be made with gold, and then you stamp that on. But here, what is this Golden Bull, short for bula, of 1356? Well, it delineated the way in which they would choose this Holy Roman Emperor, and they would get three prominent members of the church. Prominent, not just the local priest or monk or something like that. We're talking about an archbishop or a cardinal, something like that. Three prominent members of the church and four prominent lay people. Okay, a lay person is a secular person, not a member of the church. And prominent, that means not just a regular everyday person, but like a duke or a count, some type like that. So notice again, this is an odd number. Just like the Supreme Court, they didn't want 8, they didn't want 10. They got an odd number because there they don't want gridlock. When it gets to the Supreme Court, there's no further appeals. They want a decision. So they have an odd number. Here, they don't want a deadlock with the Holy Roman Emperor. They have 7 people, 3 members of the church, 4 lay people. They would get together, and when you get together for a common purpose, that is called a college. That's what a college is. People who are equal getting together for a common purpose. And since there, they were getting together for the purpose of electing a Holy Roman Emperor, it's an electoral college. If that sounds familiar to anybody, of course, that's because we have our own electoral college, which is misunderstood by most people, but still, even though people don't understand it, they need to. The president is so powerful and so significant, even though Congress, the House and Senate, if they pass a bill, president is able to veto it. Veto, again, is Latin for I forbid. Now, write this down as a test term. It's probably the longest term that we'll have during the semester. Write this down. A veto, V as in Victor, E-T-O, V-E-T-O. A veto can be overridden with 2/3, write the numbers 2/3, don't spell out 2/3. A veto can be overridden with 2/3 of the Senate and 2/3 of the House of Representatives. A veto can be overridden with 2/3 of the Senate and 2/3 of the House of Representatives. Open parentheses. Extremely difficult to get. Extremely difficult to get. Close parentheses, period. And here, the test term is rather lengthy. 2/3 of the Senate and 2/3 of the House of Representatives. That's one term, not two separate ones. 2/3 of the Senate and 2/3 of the House of Representatives. That's all one test term. That's happened to me over the years. I usually get one or two students who write it down wrong on their note sheet. It's two separate terms. It's one term. And that's another of the many abilities that this note-taking is cultivating. The ability to listen very precisely. And that will develop that ability, and you'll have that for the rest of your life. But anyway, let us proceed. I really, really wish, especially this lecture, I don't know if you've noticed it, but I kind of hem and haw and this and that, because there's a lot of stuff I wanted to go over, a lot of stuff I wanted to say, but we just need to move forward here. And then we're making amazingly good time. We're amazingly, amazingly good time, but I just wish I didn't have to cut so much of this stuff, and perhaps after the midterm we'll be able to slow it down and do things a little differently. We'll see. We'll see. Now, I was talking about the Electoral College, right? How does this work? Well, the Founding Fathers wanted us to choose not directly who should be president, but rather choose people who we thought were wise, learned, knowledgeable, because the average American back then, and unfortunately even now, they might be smart or they might be have good character and everything like that, but they don't know about international affairs. They don't know about matters of deep finance, high finance. They don't know about a lot of these things involved in what being president is, so how are they going to make these decisions? They should choose people who they believe in, and those people should make the decisions. So part of the reason was that they didn't trust people directly. They didn't trust the people directly to directly vote for president. Another part of the reason had to do with slavery. That how can you make sure that people are, that states are given credit for their population, yet not allow black people to vote? Well, you have an electoral college. That's one way to deal with it. What am I talking about here? How does an electoral college vote? Well, how does an electoral college work? Well, the people of the states, even today, this is how it works. People, when there's a presidential election, will cast their votes for who they think should be president, which party, everything like that. The party that gets the most votes in each state, and usually it's winner-take-all, so let's say Florida. In the next presidential race, let's say Joe Biden runs for re-election. Maybe he'll pass away, maybe he'll step down, whatever it is. But let's say 51% of Florida vote for him. All of Florida's electoral votes go toward the Democratic Party, the Joe Biden, or whoever it is that the Democrats have run. Even though it was only 51%, it's winner take all. So fine. Now, the winning side of the in Florida, so the Democrats, in our example, will choose all the electors to send up to vote, up to the Capitol to vote, to cast their votes, and the electors will vote in this electoral college for who becomes president. Now, one thing I need you to understand first, before I continue with this explanation, because I'm sure it's still quite confusing to you guys, but what I need you to understand is, many of you have heard that black people in America were once considered 3/5 of a person. And people who haven't taken a history class would think, oh, you know, that's a terrible thing. They should have been counted as fully people, 100% people. It's outrageous. Why were they only considered 3/5? No, that's the opposite of what's fair. The fair thing would have been to count them as not human beings at all, not give those states, those slave states, let's say Georgia or wherever it is, rather than giving them credit in the census and whatnot for the slaves, they should not have been counted at all because they weren't allowed to vote, they weren't given rights of citizenship, everything like that. So the South, these southern states, wanted the slaves counted for the purpose of population so that they would get more representatives. Well, the people in the North said, are you kidding me? We're not going to let you count these people. You don't give them rights of citizenship. Why should you get credit for them being citizens? Well, as with everything in America, there was a compromise. And we said, okay, you can't count them fully as population, but you can count them as 3/5 of a person. So we compromised on that, and that's how it worked. Now the South, these slaveholding states, did not want these black people voting. So we have this electoral college. That's another reason why we have this electoral college. You can have electors going and casting the votes, as opposed to each individual in a state voting and having that count. Because remember, black people were not allowed to vote. But the South is still getting that political power because it's still counting those black people toward their population, albeit only 3/5 of a person, but it's still adding to their population, which adds to the number of representatives they get, which adds to their political power. And they're not losing when it comes to voting for president because they're having electors go and do the voting rather than the actual every individual in the state. And remember when I said they had to balance out interest, compromise. Well, with the big states and the small states, again, that same issue arose. This is a big issue with them. Small states want everything equal, big states want majority rule. So how do they decide how many electors a state gets? Remember, electors are the people who decide who becomes president. Well, same thing. They said, let's compromise on it, let's do half of each. States get the same number of electors as their number of representatives, and representatives are based on population. And get the same number of representatives as they have senators. Senators are based, everybody's equal. Everybody gets 2. Therefore, little states like Wyoming, Montana, now these aren't actually physically little, but their population is very low. They have maybe 1 representative. So they get 1 elector in the Electoral College. But they also have 2 senators. So they get another 2 electors for that. So instead of barely getting 1 representative, which means barely 1 elector to go and vote for president, they get 3. They've tripled their amount because they also get electors for their senators. When you take these big states, Florida is one of the big states, you have 27 representatives here. In Florida, we get 27 congressmen and women. So we get 27 electors plus 2 for the 2 senators we have. Because again, it was a compromise. We want, the small states want everything equal. The big states want majority rule. They compromised. Okay, let's have both. And that's why we base the electors based on how many representatives and how many senators. So little Rhode Island, it's physically a small area, its population's really small, but they get 2 senators, which means they get, even though they barely have enough population for 1 representative, and therefore 1 elector, they also have the 2 senators, so they wind up getting 3 electors. It's still not much, just so you know. But it's a good way to balance the interests of the big and the small. Now imagine you are running for president. Where would you spend most of your time? Where would you spend most of your time? Well, certainly the big states are really important. California. California has 53 representatives, which means it gets 55 electors. 53 for their representatives, based on population, plus another 2 for their senators. 55 electors. All these little states put together with their 3 electors don't equal California. So California, you get tons and tons of electors there. Florida, you get 29 electors. You know, that's a lot. Texas is another one. So yes, the size of the state, meaning how many electors it gets, that will determine where you would go if you were running for president. But it's also another issue. It's also part of the reason why Florida is so important in these presidential elections. Yes, we're a big state, big population. But you, as when you're running for president, let's say you're a Republican, you wouldn't spend that much time in California. Let's say you're a Democrat. You wouldn't spend that much time in Texas. Why is that? Well, Texas has always been solidly, solidly Republican. It's been shifting more and more toward the Democratic side, but it's always been solidly Republican. The Democrats are not going to win Texas, at least historically. The Republicans are not going to win California. It's a very left-wing Democratic state. Now, in a way, not only will the Democrats not campaign in Texas, because they're not going to get it. Texas is going Republican, usually. Even the Republicans aren't going to spend a lot of time in Texas. Why is that? Because they know they're going to win Texas. They are going to win Texas, so they don't need to really spend much time there. So here, Florida is actually what's known as a swing state or a battleground state because it's right down the middle. It's really close. For these last few elections, it's been right, almost 50-50, and it just barely goes one way or the other. Just barely. So, therefore, both parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, are going to really fight for Florida because here they know their efforts will make a difference. Democrats aren't going to campaign much in Texas because they won't get it. Republicans aren't going to campaign much there because they know they will get it. They don't need to do much. But Florida, 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 Florida. This is the thing. Now, if you see, let's actually make this a test term here. Write this down, please. A state is given electors. In the Electoral College. A state is given electors. In the Electoral College. Equal to its total number, a state is given electors. In the Electoral College. Equal to its total number of members in the House and Senate, of members in the House and Senate, period. A state is given electors in the Electoral College equal to its total number of members in the House and Senate. The test term is members in the House and Senate. Members in the House and Senate. And then this next test term, this is a little bit odd. Now, I've told you that a state gets a number of electors equal to their total number of representatives and total number of senators. And I told you there are 100 senators. And I've told you there are 435 representatives. Therefore, you would think there would be those two added together. It's 535. That is how many electors there should be total. Well, write this down. There are 538. Write the numbers 5, 3, and 8. Don't spell it out. There are 538 electors in the Electoral College, period. The test term is 538. So where do these extra three electors come from? Why is it 538 instead of 535? What happened is, when our country was first founded, now our capital of this United States was not always Washington, D.C. Well, George Washington was sworn in Philadelphia, then the capital, in New York, then the capital was moved to Philadelphia, then there were various changes that needed to be made, and finally they said, let's create a special city. Now the Revolutionary War is over, all these kinds of things. Let's create a special area just for the federal government to do its business. Congress, the Supreme Court, the president, all these different people. They didn't want to put it in any of the states because it was feared that would give the state too much power. Whichever state you put the capital in, just by nature of being right there, of being involved with the federal government and everything so intimately, that would give it undue influence, especially at a time when state governments had a lot more power than they do today. Today, the federal government is really dominant. But, okay, they didn't want to give any state too much power, so they created a separate area in the United States which is not part of any state. Washington, D.C. Washington, D.C. stands for District of Columbia because Columbia comes from the name Columbus. It used to be what people called America, Columbia. So District of Columbia, originally called Territory of Columbia, but they changed it to District of Columbia. What happens is it's not, to this day, it isn't a part of any of the 50 states. It exists on its own under direct control of the federal government. Now, that wasn't a big deal initially, but over time, its population grew and grew and grew, and I know there's at least 500,000 people there now, at least 500,000 citizens. And all those people, since they're not a part of any of the 50 states, they didn't get to vote on any of politicians. So they had no right to vote. Now they added in some changes. Today they get to vote for a mayor and things like that. And sometime back they actually changed the Constitution to give these people in the District of Columbia three electoral votes. So even though Washington, D.C. isn't a part of any of the 50 states, the people there still get three electoral votes for president.
Now, when is the presidential election held? Okay, most of you know it's held every 4 years. That's fine. That's good. When every 4 years? Well, some of you would say November. That's good. And some of you might even get more detail, but please write this down as your last test term. The presidential election is held. The presidential election is held on the first Tuesday. Presidential election is held on the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November, period. The presidential election is held on the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November, period. And the test term is first Monday. Now, what the heck is going on here? Is this some kind of logic puzzle? What's happening here? Well, like everything in life, in history, and everything, there is a reason for all this stuff, and it makes sense once we know the history. So first, we look back through American history, especially when the country was being founded. What did most people do for a living in America? Well, they were farmers. And farming is very difficult work. Lots of work. You wake up before the sun rises and you work until the sun goes down, if not longer. And you have to do the planting, you have to do the weeding, you have to do all this stuff. It's very, very busy. Finally, after you have done with all the harvesting, that takes you into November. So now people have some time to actually go and do the voting, because the harvesting and all the stuff with the planting and everything with the crops is done. So it can be any time after that, which means winter. But you want it as early in winter as possible, because the snow gets really bad, the cold gets really bad, the frigid, everything like that. So as early in winter as possible, so that puts it at very early in November. Again, every 4 years. Now, why is it on a Tuesday? Why not some other day? Well, again, we put ourselves in that position. It's not like today where you just drive to the polling place or whatever it is. People are very concentrated in cities. Most people in America were widely dispersed. And you have to factor in a full day of travel to get to the polling place. Then you wait in line for a full day, let's say. Then one more day to get back home. So even though it makes sense to do this stuff on a Monday, you know, first working day of the week, if you have the elections on a Monday, that means that one day to travel there is going to be on a Sunday, and that is out of the question. The Sabbath, the Sunday, is a day of rest, is a day for the Lord. Not supposed to be using your horse and buggy to drive around and try and get to the voting place. Therefore, when you put it on a Tuesday, now the people have their Sabbath, have their Sunday, the day of the Lord. Monday they travel. Tuesday they vote, Wednesday they come back home. That's what it is. Now, why the first Tuesday? Okay, the first Tuesday, again, you want it early in November. That's fine. And it's not only the cold. There's also another reason why you don't want to have it too late into winter. But why on earth is it the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November? Well, I'll give you a hint. Sometimes, on some years, the first Tuesday in November is November 1st. In other words, some years, November 1st is on a Tuesday. So some years, you would have elections November 1st, which is unacceptable because November 1st is All Saints' Day. It's a day of religious obligation. It's not supposed to be where you go to do the voting or anything like that, and therefore they made this rule so it can never be on November 1st. And that's true for all our elections, not just the presidential. So you might want to get prepared for that, registering to vote if you have not already done so, or maybe you don't care. I mean, to vote. I've met people who just think that it's a waste of time. What is their one vote going to do? What difference does it make? Why do they feel like a fool standing in line? Or even Florida has mail-in ballot where you don't have to stand in line. It's very convenient. But I'm just telling you, even though I don't agree with that, I'm just telling you these different perspectives, and you do what you will. Emma Goldman once said that if voting changed anything, they'd make it illegal. She was a feminist anarchist in America, in New York. But this is food for thought. But it's also important, especially since we just had Independence Day, to remember that a lot of people died to give us this right to vote. Of course, they died to give us the right to not vote if we don't want to, if we find it useless or whatever. But again, the choice is ours. We have that freedom, and history, seeing the history, will inform our decision making.